Hello, everybody. Welcome to this installment of Politatine. As always, I'm your host, Damien, joined by Varun. Be sure to stick to the end for some important updates and enjoy the rest of the podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode here of Politatine. I'm joined by Varun, as always.
Hey, guys. My name is Varun, and I am the co-host for today's Politatine podcast. The date is Wednesday, June 17th, 2020, and we're here today discussing a lot of the issues that have been uncovered ever since our interview with Ted Terry this Monday. The topic of today's podcast is going to be around John Bolton's book and how it kind of exposes a bunch of truths about our nation that we didn't know about before this week. And so, Damien, if you want to go into depth about what our podcast is and who we are.
Yeah, for sure. So, as Varun was saying, we're going to talk about a little bit, different political stuff. That's really what we do on the show. But I think before we get into that, we just want to catch up a little bit from last time. The interview with Ted Terry was absolutely amazing. What did you think of it, Varun?
I have to agree. I think it was a great interview for all of us. It really enlightened my perspective, as I said last time, about, you know, the political field and also DeKalb County, which is very close to where I live. I think it'd be awesome for all of you guys to go on our Spotify, Apple Music, wherever you get your podcasts, watch that podcast to really help yourselves learn more about politics and how Ted became a politician. I think it's a great thing for all of us to listen to as Americans.
Yeah, for sure. And then don't want to forget to mention that this is another episode that we're doing outside in the middle of nowhere. We're live from Texas. We're usually live from Atlanta. So if we're having some background noise, that's why the connection is going to be a little bit worse too. But beyond that, I think we're ready for this episode. How's Chicago been since last time, Varun?
Chicago has been good. It's been kind of bipolar with the weather, but I think now it's settled down. You know, we're having less rain and it's more sunny, so I'm glad about that. Going outside more, I've been deprived of that because of the coronavirus, but it's getting better. How about you, Damien?
Yeah, no, it rained for the first time, I think, in probably like a couple weeks over here in Texas, and it only rained for like 15 minutes. But that day we went in, we picked up some goats actually, and we've been messing around with some goats out here in the middle of nowhere, just trying to get everything settled. It's been a lot of fun. I'm really enjoying it. Unfortunately, I've been away from Twitter and stuff, even though that's the main focus of our podcast. It's a little bit more difficult to get all that information out here. So I'm going to be relying on you to keep me in the loop.
Absolutely. So, to begin our podcast, on that note about Twitter, Twitter kind of erupted today, Damien, about a certain event that happened earlier this week. It was John Bolton releasing kind of his account about Donald Trump and his presidency and how there was a lot of crises that were kind of happening in that presidency. So what John Bolton said, if any of our viewers who don't really know what he said in his book, said that, you know, China's president Xi Jinping was asked by Trump to support his campaign by investing in more American soybeans. So he was to kind of help in his campaign, meddle, as you would say, in his campaign for the 2020 election. And the most kind of horrific thing that I saw from John Bolton's account was the fact that Trump and the G20 summit with other leaders from the international scale showed support for China and Xi Jinping's kind of housing of concentration camps for the Uyghur Muslims, for 1 million Uyghur Muslims in China. And I think it's absolutely horrific that the president is going out on the international scale and supporting these things. And besides the fact, John Bolton was also talking about in his book how Trump is kind of sucking up to other leaders who manipulated him. So I think that in my perspective, it shows that our nation and the leadership, especially under the Trump administration, is very vulnerable. It makes the United States of America not the most powerful on the international scale and very, very, very weak in some respects. So how do you feel about Trump supporting things like the Uyghur Muslims concentration camps and China supporting his campaign for 2020, Damien?
You know, I think that it's a weird situation. I mean, it's just, I don't know, this whole thing, I think the word of this decade, and I guess the latter part of the 2010s was unprecedented. I think that's what it's been and what it's being. It's just, it's weird. I don't know, you know, how often you see stuff like this happening. In 2016, you had him asking for Russia to release Hillary's emails, and now you're hearing that you have another communist country, or communist-based country, giving Donald Trump support again. It's just a little odd, and I think that we've been the laughingstock of the rest of the world for quite some time now. Since 2016, I think that that has been a little bit more dangerous. But you know, I guess this kind of leans back to how do you think Trump dealt with North Korea? You know, his diplomatic stance on North Korea. How do you think that went?
I think he had somewhat of a right idea when dealing with North Korea in terms of creating a more diplomatic relationship with that nation. But I think that going back to what he did, he should have been more powerful and I guess the word I mean to say is decisive. Because North Korea is not a regular nation. It is a dictatorship, and it's a nation that should be controlled as a nuclear nation. So I think that he dealt with it more on friendly terms. Should have been really extending his arm as a kind of helping hand instead of being a one-to-one ally. Because we are never going to be allies with the North Korea regime. Because they are a dictatorship, and they're a dictatorship which is not doing well for the world in general. So I think that it's important for our president and our nation to make a very decisive stance on that kind of dictatorship and not say, I support it, but say, I see what you're doing, away from it.
Yeah, no, it was interesting because, you know, you've obviously had no other U.S. president really give North Korea that kind of recognition. And it kind of gave Kim Jong-un a little bit, I guess you would consider it a power trip. But I don't think that you could say in hindsight, obviously hindsight's always going to be 2020. But in hindsight, looking at it, you know, I guess it wasn't the worst situation. Obviously, nothing bad came out of it. I don't know if anything bad would have come out if you would have dealt with it in any other situation. But you know, I only bring it up because we're talking about the United States on a national scale, but I think we're only looking weaker and weaker because of the fact that we're pulling out of, you know, the World Health Organization, and we pulled out of the Paris Agreement, and I don't know. Is there anything else that I'm forgetting here that we've kind of pulled out of, Rune?
Yeah, I think that covers the majority of things we've pulled out of. But Damien, I wanted to mention upon your previous point about Hillary Clinton and how Trump kind of persuaded Russia to release emails of Hillary Clinton that weren't released before. I'm going to read to you a quote that John Bolton was talking about in his book. It said that, for example, Russian President Vladimir Putin compared Venezuelan opposition leader to 2016 Democratic presidential nominee Clinton. So what Bolton was saying in saying that was that Putin was trying to kind of coerce Trump into acquiescing to his terms and referencing Venezuelan opposition leader as being kind of related to Clinton. I think that many of these leaders in our nation, not only Kim Jong-un, not only Putin, but internationally, I think they're taking advantage of what Trump reacts to and using that to sway the United States of America because he is the leader of the free world. And they're using this kind of rhetoric, spike up tensions, make President Trump do things he's not going to do otherwise. So how do you feel about Trump being susceptible, in Bolton's terms, to this kind of coercion by international leaders?
You know, I think that it brings a new perspective. Reading that, I hadn't really thought of him being persuaded. Per se, I hadn't paid attention to that. But now that it's being brought up, I could see it. I could see how it happens. You know, he does. I think he's easier, once you understand him, he is easier to kind of persuade. I don't know, it's a difficult situation, and it puts America in a difficult situation, and you know, it kind of leaves Donald Trump just looking as a puppet to other nations for them to use. Excuse me. And you know, it just puts us in an uncomfortable position, and again, it goes back to the fact that we're really a laughingstock. And you know, obviously, with the whole riots and stuff that's going on in the world, not only in America anymore, you know, all over the world, it started over here in the United States, and you have the president hiding inside of his bunker, and you have Bunker Boy trending. You have a very interesting climate right now going on around the world. We spent the early parts of the 20th century, you know, trying to build our military power and trying to play a role on the global scale, and I kind of think that we're falling back a little bit now.
I have to agree. I think that, you know, being an AP U.S. history student, being a high school student, I have seen America triumph, and I've witnessed and read about America triumphing on a historic scale. Being a proud American, I am disheartened by things that things that have been released as of late, you know, Trump kind of being manipulated by other countries to acquiesce to their wishes, it makes me less proud of our country and more resentful towards the Trump administration. I think it's important for our country to, you know, do what's best for us and not what's best for these other leaders of foreign nations, because at the end of the day, you know, what we're fighting for is American independence and American prosperity, and not Russia and not China and not any other countries. But on the other hand, we also have to support international efforts in terms of human rights. I think that Trump is breaking both borders that I'm talking about by supporting the Uyghur Muslim concentration camps. First of all, he's not supporting American interests, and he's trying to suck up to, I think, Xi Jinping. And second of all, he's not supporting human rights across an international scale. I think the Uyghur Muslim concentration camps are a complete and utter disbandment of human rights across the world. So I think that we should be taking a very decisive stance on these issues and other issues that reflect our nation. But speaking of decisive stances, Damien, I wanted to mention that, I don't know if you've read this because you've been in Texas, obviously, but the Republicans today, they unveiled a new bill in the Senate, which basically is counter...
In the Senate, you said, because you were cutting out there. You said that they unveiled a new bill in the Senate?
I did.
Okay.
So they unveiled a new bill in the Senate, which was kind of undercutting the Democratic bill that they released a couple of weeks ago, I think last Friday. But what they said was they wanted to kind of ban chokeholds, first of all, and increase more study on black people and white people in the policing department and that kind of a relationship. Well, how do you feel about Republicans finally taking a kind of acceptance and taking accountability for the issues that our nation is facing?
You know, I think that it's a good thing, and I hope, again, you know, a couple episodes ago, I think it was one of our other outside episodes, I kept mentioning the term of maturity, but I hope that the maturity lasts time. I hope that that it's showing growth and that it's just not something that's happening because of right now. You know, that it's not just happening because of the climate. I hope that we take steps forward and we review and we really do change for the better. And these bills aren't just being proposed because they want votes or because they want change and they want America happy just for right now. We need to look at how we can do this in the long term and how we can keep growing as a nation and including everyone else. And that starts with leadership at the top, and I'm happy that they're taking at least those steps. Whatever we can do as a nation, just coming together and really solving the problem.
I think that what you said is extremely beneficial and kind of related to what's happening today, because seeing them especially make certain moves towards having Democratic support, what they're doing is they're kind of unveiling policies that Democrats have been calling for decades, really pushing them forth. For example, they're making lynching kind of a hate crime in this new set of bills. So I think that they're making a very valiant effort to gain Democratic support and bipartisan support for these new legislations on a nationwide level. But what they're doing is they're also kind of cutting short the amount of legislation that is happening, the Democratic bills. So a major point that Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats have been pushing forth is that these Republican kind of bills against law enforcement have not addressed the real problem at hand. And that problem is accountability and responsibility for policing incidents. So what they're saying is the Democratic bill includes kind of having more body cams, less kind of support for police officers on a law enforcement level. And it does not directly bring accountability to the police officers by not having extra body cams and not having less kind of insurance money and money to support their cases in the federal courts. So how do you feel about Democrats going against their policies? I'm going to ask you now. And is it a sign of disunity? Is it a sign of mind disunity? Or is it a sign of really taking control and accountability?
I think that it depends on how they're going at it. I don't think that they should be going after it, per se, and attacking the Republican bill and saying they're not doing this and that. Instead, they should be saying, why don't you guys also include this? Or why don't we also include this? And try to create a conversation as opposed to pointing fingers and saying that they're not doing this and that they look bad because of this or that. But speaking on the whole issue of – or well, what do you think of that? What do you think about the idea that they kind of propose it as more of a constructive criticism as opposed to just straight criticism and pointing fingers?
I mean, Damien, to be honest, Nancy Pelosi's overall kind of quotation, she's saying that the Senate proposal was without transparency and accountability is completely inadequate, quote, not mine. I think that it's kind of undercutting what the Republicans have done.
Yeah.
And we have to accept the Republicans have done something instead of nothing, and maybe say, you know, it's not enough, not completely say it's inadequate, not making any step whatsoever. And I think that the Republican bill does do a lot of things, and one of the things that I liked about it is to kind of name a bunch of their policies after, for example, George Floyd, Walter Scott, and Breonna Taylor, different acts within that bill. So it kind of brings a kind of lasting legacy for these people who have died as a result and casualty of police brutality. I did like that about them, and they're doing a lot. But it contradicts the perspective, Damien, and I was going to mention this to you earlier. I actually played this video, but I guess it's not a possibility for us with the overall climate we're having with two different states. But I wanted to talk about something that happened in the House of Representatives, I think, today. Right. So Representative Eric Swalwell, he said, I would yield to any of my colleagues in the Republican panel who can unequivocally say, as we calibrate where we are right now, that Black Lives Matter. What happened is immediately a Republican representative named Matt Gaetz immediately said, I thank the gentleman for yielding. Does the gentleman believe that all lives matter as well? He continued to say, you know, does he believe that all lives matter? And does he believe that not only Black Lives Matter, but all lives matter? I think it's absolutely disgusting. How do you feel about that, Dean?
Yeah, you know, if someone couldn't hear what Arun was saying at the end, he said that he feels that it's absolutely disgusting. And in a sense, I just have to completely agree with you. I think that people just try to undermine the movement of Black Lives Matter by saying, well, do you think that all lives matter? It's just, I don't know. It's just like, it's an ignorant statement. It's like a... I really don't know how to talk about it. Of course, all lives matter, but apparently Black lives don't in America, and that's what they're talking about. They're saying all lives matter, and so do Black lives. So please start treating it like that. If that's what the slogan has to be for people to take it seriously, then are we gonna have to change it to that? Is it gonna be all lives matter, and so do Black lives? Why does it turn into this thing where you're saying, if you're saying Black lives matter, you're not saying that white lives matter. Of course they do. It goes back to the video that we were playing the other day, where at the end, the lady that was speaking in the video, she says, white people ought to be happy that we're looking for equality and not revenge. And the quote, Black lives matter, is just that. They're not looking to say that white lives don't. They're looking to say that Black lives need to start mattering to people because they haven't for the past 400 years, 200 years in America. You know, as we've been a nation, they haven't mattered. So for us to still have this idea of ignorance and to be stubborn and to say, well, all lives matter, we get it. That's the point. All lives do matter. So start treating Black lives with respect as well. I just think that it's honestly ignorance, and it's difficult to call it ignorance when you know what you're doing. But I think that you said it was a Republican, correct?
It was.
So I think that Republican's gonna face that scrutiny not only online but hopefully in the polls and in the voting booth.
And I thought so as well. I mean, I think I absolutely agree with what you're saying about. What he's doing is absolutely ignorant, because when we're looking at people saying that all lives matter, that's one thing. Looking at representatives at our national level who has been elected by the American people saying the exact same ignorant thing, that says something about the American people and what we believe in. So they're supposed to be representing us, and I don't think that all lives matter and speaking about it in that manner represents all of us. That bring up a very good point. Because all lives matter, it has been something that's been common sense for centuries, ever since we've had a government, or you know, a just government after slavery was abolished and we had more less segregation. I think that Black Lives Matter has been something that has been recently brought up because Black lives have not mattered as much as other lives. I think we should recognize that and say, you know, all lives do matter, but all lives cannot matter until Black lives matter. Because we're a part of that. But I think that upon your previous point, I was looking at Matt Gaetz's Twitter and what he was getting in response to what he said earlier. And he posted, proudly posted what he said. And he was like, all lives do matter. And I looked at his comments, and there was not a single person out of like 100 comments saying that that's disgusting, that that's not the right thing to do. There were just people saying, yeah, they fail to recognize that all lives matter, and they're just saying Black Lives Matter kind of erasing white lives and other lives in the U.S. I was like, really? Really, is that what we're saying right now? How do you feel about his comment section being kind of overblown with those things instead of the real things that we need to be hearing?
You know, I think that, again, it goes back to kind of the issue where it's these are people, and we're not going to have everyone be agreeing on the same ideas. You're always going to have people saying all lives matter, and you're always going to have people that are racist. But as Americans and as the majority who aren't racist, we need to do what people are saying right now and actively speak out against racism. And honestly, the term all lives matter is becoming a counter protest to Black Lives Matter. And when you're counter protesting a movement that is supposed to include the fact that all lives do matter, so we're going to cry out and say that our lives need to begin to matter, then you're creating a blatant counter protest to that, then you are being racist. And, you know, as I was going back on the point saying that we're never going to have all 100% of Americans be not racist, but we can't have our leaders be racist. And it's gotten to the point where we just can't have our leaders be not racist. We need to have all of our leaders actively speak out against racism. So it's a difficult thing to hear, especially on the national scale, that people are being this ignorant when it comes to things. But I mean, it's just disappointing, and we need to show that in the voting booth.
We do. I think an immediate effect is, you know, Representative Gaetz getting less votes from a lot of people who are kind of discontent with what he's saying on a national scale and his overall policies. I think another major effect of what he's saying is that a lot of people are going to be emboldened what he said and be like, you know, maybe that's right. Maybe All Lives Matter is a valid thing to say in response to Black Lives Matter. And that's the scary thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the scary thing is that people will take what he says, use it to validate what they're saying, and I think that it is absolutely not the right thing to do. Disgusting. Yeah, go ahead.
That's why we can't have leaders that do that thing. We have to have leaders that are not giving these people disgusting ideas. We need to have leaders that are being leaders and that are leading for all. And obviously, by saying all lives matter, you're intending to do that, but what you're actually doing is being ignorant to the fact that Black lives have not mattered in America for the past 200 years. So we need to get rid of those people that continue with the stubborn ideology that we're saying that all lives do not matter and that only Black lives matter. That's not the slogan. It's a slogan of inclusion, not exclusion, and it's honest ignorance. It's ignorance, and we need to just get rid of leaders that are doing that. And I think that's hopefully the change that we're going to see in America.
Absolutely. And upon your previous point about change in America and our leaders taking responsibility, you saw a very unlikely person kind of take responsibility for what's occurring, and that was Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, said that the stain is not totally gone from slavery and the Civil War. So kind of a lot of people in the Republican Party have not yet kind of gave a voice to systematic racism in our nation. But seeing Mitch McConnell, a very, very prominent figure in the Republican Party, say these kinds of things has emboldened me and said maybe there is a kind of solution to the crisis which is happening. How do you feel about Mitch McConnell going out and saying these things as compared to other leaders?
You know, I feel happy and I feel relieved, but it's kind of disappointing that it's 2020 and you're barely hearing Mitch McConnell say these things. I'm happy that it's happening eventually, but again, it is a little disappointing that this is barely happening now, that these changes are barely happening now. But I think that it's something that's very good because you're not having our president come out and say it. And we talked about it a few podcasts ago, but I think it was our first podcast where I kind of called out Mitch McConnell. What would happen is Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump would go after people who didn't agree with Donald's ideology, and they would get them to be replaced and to not be voted in. Speaking of Republicans here, they would replace Republicans who didn't agree with Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell. But here you're kind of having an outlier where Mitch McConnell isn't kind of agreeing with the president, and he's kind of doing his own thing, and he's saying something that I think for once can be only seen as right and as the positive thing and as the correct thing to be saying. Again, I hope that this is a thing, a sign of maturity and not a sign of a cry for voters in November.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that I hope and pray that we're making steps towards more inclusion, bipartisan support for Black Lives Matter across all party lines, and, you know, not just dismissing the idea as all lives matter. You know, he could have done that. He could have said, no, all lives matter, and they need to matter more than ever now. But he made the right choice in this circumstance. I don't know if it was for the votes or if it was actually made upon a moral decision, but he did make a stance. And one thing I wanted to mention, Damien, was that over the past couple of days, we saw a landmark victory by the Supreme Court in guaranteeing employment, and not employment, but, you know, no discrimination in employment against LGBTQ people in that community, and saying that, you know, companies and corporations can't deny people a job based upon their status as being gay or transgender or any kind of sexuality. So I think it's a very, very surprising, and I was almost jumped when I saw it, Damien, because the person who wrote that bill was Neil Gorsuch. And that's the guy who we thought was not going to do anything of the matter because he was appointed by Trump, and Trump made tons of moves to kind of discriminate against the LGBT community. So I think that it was surprising that a conservative Supreme Court under Neil Gorsuch approved that kind of ruling. So how do you feel about that coming into fruition and how it came into fruition with the whole conservative Supreme Court?
Yeah, no, I think that it's a great thing, to be honest. And obviously, you know, with the more conservative Supreme Court and all the changes that have been happening, I think that it's about time. And, you know, the Supreme Court has always, and it was meant to be a point where, or a place where the law was just looked under by the Constitution. And I'm happy that that's actually what's happening. And I'm happy that these decisions are being made. Apologies for the background noise here, but I'm happy that these decisions are actually being made in the Supreme Court, and that the Constitution is being followed in the Supreme Court. I think that it's about time, and I think that that I'm very happy, honestly, to just see change happening in America. And again, I just hope that it keeps coming.
Absolutely, Damien. It's a very good point. And I wanted to mention one other thing that with, you know, healthcare. And with Donald Trump and many other Republican senators, and Trump unveiled a new policy, actually, I don't know when it was, but it was very recently, which said that hospitals could discriminate against LGBT members of that community in offering them health care. And they could essentially deny people as a part of that community and based upon their sexuality from receiving help. That's something that's not going to be supported in a lot of lawsuits because of the new Supreme Court ruling. Neil Gorsuch actually went directly against what Trump did earlier by making that ruling, which is absolutely revolutionary and nothing I've heard of for a long, long, long time. But I did want to kind of call the attention towards what Trump ruled. And he ruled, obviously, that healthcare kind of people could deny people in the LGBT community healthcare. And I wanted to bring in the Republican side of things. The Republicans, a lot of my friends who are Republican, actually said that it's a good thing because a lot of doctors should not have to deal with kind of women who are transgender as males. And it's a traumatic kind of thing for doctors. How do you feel about that perspective as compared to perspective of healthcare for all?
You know, I think that it's honestly, it's something that's kind of gross because that'd be like saying that it's difficult for doctors to deal with patients that have cancer. You know, I can see kind of where that perspective is coming from, but are we just going to deny people healthcare because of the decisions that they choose to make? I think that this is a free country, and I think that you know, obviously, when you're talking about something like healthcare and you're talking about health for all, you really need to be able to give that to all Americans, regardless of the decisions that they've made in their lives. Are you no longer going to give criminals, murderers, healthcare because of the decisions that they've made? If you're not going to give someone that's transgender healthcare, then you can make the argument that a criminal shouldn't be given healthcare either. And if you're not going to give someone that's gay, you know, the proper recognition, maybe their AIDS treatment because of the fact that they don't go along with your religious beliefs because of what, you know, it's something that's gross. And I think that it's an idea that's gross. And we just need to move along from it. And we just need to let people make their decisions. And just people need to be respected for it. Obviously, you know, you could say that the doctors have the right to make their decision. But, you know, it's you go into a field to help people. And I don't think that you should be discriminating.
Yeah, it's a hard discussion to have this world, and I do disagree with your overall comparison of having prisoners receive healthcare as compared to people of the LGBTQ status receiving not receiving healthcare. I think that people of that community have not done anything inherently wrong towards society. They've simply made a conscious choice of their sexuality, whereas prisoners have done a societal wrong. I don't think it's reasonable for us to compare them. And I don't know if that's what you're trying to
Well, what I was trying to do was saying that if we're not going to be giving transgender people health care, then why are we going to be giving prisoners health care? You know, I was trying to say that one made a decision that didn't affect anyone else, and the other one made a decision that maybe took someone else's life or affected them permanently.
Right, and that makes perfect sense. I did want to mention one other type of decision that you were mentioning. We talked a lot about decisions in the field of healthcare and things of such nature. I wanted to mention one other type of decision. That decision is what field you want to go into as a career. When you're young and you're looking for what to become as an adult, and you don't want to give healthcare to people of the LGBTQ community, you shouldn't go into the field of healthcare and doctors, because you make an oath, you take an oath, support anybody and uphold their life and their kind of everything and not let them go to waste because of anything. I think everybody's human, and we should uphold human rights and the right to life above everything else. And if you don't believe in that, then you should not be a doctor in the United States of America, because that's our kind of policy, and that's the oath you're taking. And also, a second point I wanted to bring up is that I believe healthcare is a human right. No matter what kind of human you are, no matter your sexuality, your race, your religion, healthcare is a human right, and we should stay true to that kind of message.
Yeah, no, for sure. And it kind of goes back to this thing where you shouldn't have police officers that have the idea that transgender people should die, kind of how you have doctors that apparently are having this idea that transgender people shouldn't receive healthcare. That's going in the same lines. Both of these people have taken oaths to protect and serve, and that's protect, you know, and serve everyone. And again, healthcare is a human right, and that's honestly also why I believe in universal healthcare. And I think that you shouldn't be losing an arm and a leg literally. And then figuratively also be having to pay that in order to make up for the healthcare bills that you're having. It's gross, and I don't think that anyone should be discriminated against for anything, honestly. It's a human right, especially in healthcare. That's something that's a human right. And the people that are going into this field have made the decision that they want to help people, and I think that they should want to help people regardless of who they are. And it has to be the same with police officers, as we're seeing these riots across America. We have to see these people that want to help people regardless of who they are, and what the officer or the doctor's beliefs are.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that talking about police officers, should also mention that you can be a racist. It's your opinion, but in the most respectful way, don't be, first of all. But second of all, if you're a racist and you don't want to treat black people or people of the Asian descent or Latino people in the same way as you do treat other races, you shouldn't be a police officer, because you're taking an oath once again to support anybody no matter what their race is and treat them in the exact same way. I think that it goes back to the same exact discussion. So you're kind of giving your life towards an ideal, the ideal of equality and the ideal of upholding a person's life, whether it be law enforcement or whether it be healthcare. And I think that you shouldn't be a police officer if you're not willing to see beyond race lines. Just look at a person as if they're just a human being, an American. And that's something I strongly believe in, as you brought up that point.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's like if you had a firefighter that saw a house that was burning down and they were like, a gay person lives in that house. Not going to put out that one. It's just like it's a stupid thing to say. Obviously, everyone can make their own decisions as adults, and that goes on to whether you dislike transgender people. But if you dislike transgender people, if you dislike African-Americans, if you dislike Latino people, then don't go into a field where you're going to have to serve them and where you're taking an oath to serve them and where your occupation is to serve them. It's just ridiculous. And again, I know that everyone has that decision, but or everyone has that the free will to make the decision to hate, but in America, those people need to be frowned upon no matter what.
Absolutely. I think we have to push us and our peers to change their ways, because being a racist is not to be accepted in America anymore. I don't care if it's free speech or free thought or something the Constitution does kind of show support for. I think we as Americans should be taking responsibility, saying that is not okay for people in our nation. They're better than that, and to kind of persuade people, as Daryl Davis did, with the KKK members, over 200 that he converted to not being a member of that organization, say that is not okay, and I can't sit by and see my fellow Americans, my fellow friends, jump into that abyss. It is an abyss, you know. It's a hole that is sometimes not something people return from, and it's something that Americans should frown upon under any circumstance. So wanted to also mention how Trump has been racking in, as many people on the conservative side have said, over 1 million RSVPs for his rallies, campaign rallies, later in this month. And we're seeing Anthony Fauci come out and say, you know, it's not okay to attend these rallies because it's a huge, huge, huge threat for the coronavirus. And he's obviously the White House's coronavirus director. So how do you feel about Trump still organizing these rallies against Fauci's recommendations and against social distancing guidelines?
It's kind of, again, it goes with the mask thing that I mentioned earlier. It's not something that you want to see a leader doing. And I think in November, we're going to see that that's not something that we want in leadership. Obviously, you have Joe Biden not doing any rallies, not really campaigning heavily besides virtually. And I think that that's the way that we need to proceed. It's the safest way. And he's not only looking out for the people who would attend the rallies or would attend his events, but he's looking out for all Americans and showing them that even he can put his political success aside in order to see all of America prosper and to come out as a leader figure in the United States of America. I think that it's just disappointing that we're really having these campaign rallies. And I'm not saying that it's disappointing because I think that necessarily it's a bad thing. I think that people can make their decisions and stuff. But it, as the leader of America, you don't want to incline people to be making these decisions where they're going to these huge events. I personally think that younger people and people of younger age and stuff are really shouldn't be worried per se about the coronavirus. I think that if you're healthy and you know you do exercise and you eat well, that you shouldn't be worried. But a lot of the president's base is older and in certain circumstances unhealthy. And obviously, you know, the president also is extremely overweight. He's morbidly obese, and you know, he's putting himself at risk. And we might, you know, lose our leader or what some people still might view as a leader. And that would, regardless of how you see the president, that would still be a tragedy to America. And I think that it's just ignorance.
I think it is. A lot of conservatives and Trump himself is going out and saying that Joe Biden is being selfish in not organizing campaign rallies and looking after his own health over the health of, I guess, what he's saying is our nation. But I think that mentioned that I view things on the other perspective. Joe Biden is instead being selfless and kind of, as you said, sacrificing his Democratic success and not holding campaign rallies for the success of our country and of the people who would attend his rallies. Mm-hmm. So the health of our nation. Trump is doing the exact opposite, selfishly trying to kind of advance his political agenda and not focusing upon the health of the people attending his things, the health of America, for that matter.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think, I don't know if I brought it up on the podcast, but this is honestly a view, an opinion that I've had. They've made fun of Joe Biden for not campaigning, you know, and it's weird. It's weird that you'd be like, hey, why aren't you doing the thing that maybe could beat me? And I personally think it's because they see that Joe Biden is having the success without having to go out, and they think that maybe he's getting some success because of the fact that he's actually not campaigning. It's kind of a weird situation that we see here in America, but because he's not campaigning, he's showing the fact that he's a good leader and that he wants to be a leader in America again, and it's getting kind of his vote A little bit up, whereas when since Donald Trump wants to go out and campaign, maybe he feels like he has to campaign, so he's trying to bully Joe into going into it, so that it's both of them looking bad, so that once again you're choosing between lesser evils as you had to choose in 2016. I think that maybe it's just a strategy to kind of push Joe into doing it, and I don't think that it's going to work, because I think honestly people are loving Joe for not going out and campaigning and maybe going out and protesting. We're seeing the Don go out and campaign, but we're not seeing him step out and protest, and you have to wonder why. Why isn't he marching with African Americans, but he's going to invite all these white people RSVP'd at his rallies?
It was a great point that you mentioned last. He's not marching with the black people, but he's inviting a lot of people to attend his campaign rallies, a lot of whom are white, as you said. I think that what we're seeing here is it may be a political ploy, kind of coercing Joe Biden into kind of campaigning with his fellow peers. But I think that there's a stark contrast between the candidates that we have for upcoming election. The candidates cares about health of his people and his supporters, instead of his more than his kind of campaign successes. And the other person on the other spectrum, Donald J. Trump, is okay to sacrifice thousands of lives for his campaign. Well, I think that there's two different styles of campaigning, and we have to make that conscious choice. Are we going to support somebody who's risking lives for his own personal gain? Are we going to support somebody who is sitting on the sidelines and risking his campaign for the gain of the American people?
Yeah, no, I think that is interesting. And that we're now that we're on the topic of this whole campaigning stuff, obviously, this is something that we can talk about later, but I'm gonna drop this here in case we want to pick it up later. He obviously started campaigning in Arizona, Tulsa, Arizona, where you had the massive massacre of African American wealth, prominent African American people, but that's there. But the main thing that I want to talk about here was the coal miners. In 2016, Donald Trump had this huge promise to bring back coal mines, and that was an utter failure. In 2016, he had these campaign promises to build a wall, and that was an utter failure. An utter failure in the terms that he was talking about building this great wall that people were going to look forward to, that people were going to look to, and it was kind of going to be a staple of America, kind of like Mount Rushmore is, and that was a failure. Do you think that that's going to kind of show up, or do you think that he's going to make those promises again to kind of build the wall? He relied a lot on chance. You had lock her up, build the wall, bring back coal, drain the swamp. You're not seeing this, and we're a couple months out from the election. What do you think's happening?
I think that, Damien, it's almost like we have high school class president election.
By the way, sorry, lock him up is now trending as I brought that up.
I didn't see that earlier before. But, I think it's a response to John Bolton's book. But besides the fact, as I was talking about, we have high school class president elections. And a lot of candidates make kind of unreasonable claims about how they're going to bring back the slushy machines or have a basketball team for our school. We don't have a basketball team, by the way.
Yeah.
they're like, let's bring back a basketball team. It's not feasible.
Yeah.
Those candidates may end up winning for one term, but I don't think they're going to win 2 years in a row.
Yeah.
That's what President Donald Trump is trying to do, win 2 years in a row on the same exact promises, which he's failed to kind of carry forth. And upon your previous point about coal miners in America, I think that Donald Trump wanted to bring back coal mining. It was a very unrealistic thing, because coal mining has been on the decline no matter what he does. Investing in that industry is not going to make it any better, because it's going to decline and decline and decline, even though those monetary investments are going to be there. They're eventually going to run out. I think America is ready for green energy, and coal mining is not the future. It's going to continue to decline. As Joe Biden's saying, it's important for us as Americans to invest in green energy and create more green energy jobs instead of reinvesting in something that's already dying. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, and I think that it's a good thing, but we can't just create green energy jobs. And obviously, we've been talking about not about the fact that we left behind our African American brothers and sisters and our minorities. we can't leave behind these people that have worked in the coal mines and their families who may not be as educated as some African Americans or the majority of white people, because, you know, they've worked in coal mines for years and years and years, and as you have that interest industry dying out and you have kind of these coal cities, these coal mine cities kind of going dark, you have to wonder what their generation is going to look like and what those people are going to become. So you can't leave their kids behind either. We have to make sure that we kind of don't have another key on discrimination here.
I think you're right. We can't leave these people behind. I think that what I was saying is kind of in support of not leaving them behind, because, you know, when we're having a dying industry, people working in that industry are going to be left behind once that industry dies. They're not going to have jobs, and it's going to result in a high unemployment rate for Americans across the board in that industry. So I think that the solution here in not leaving these people behind is not creating more monetary reserves for the coal mining industry. It lies in making that gradual transition and kind of embracing that gradual transition to green jobs. And it's not obviously saying no coal right now. It's saying let's create more green jobs and transfer workers to those jobs and make more sustainable wages and more sustainable workplace environments for these people and not leave them behind.
Yeah, no, I think that we just need to start. I talked about rebudgeting a lot, and rebudgeting specifically, I was mentioning the police department and kind of rebudgeting and training as opposed to militarization. And I think that we kind of need to make the switch here in the whole United States as well. We need to kind of stop rebudgeting or budgeting so much in our military and then going and spending it on controversial wars that oftentimes are looked back as dumb, that we spend billions and sometimes trillions of dollars on. And instead, hey, invest $1 trillion in a goddamn, in a bad community, and you're gonna see that community prosper. But obviously, don't just invest $1 trillion and kick those people out. Give the people the money and kind of help them get on their feet. Give them an education. Obviously, you know, Ted Terry was mentioning last time that we kind of see when the education, the quality of education goes up, you kind of see these people prosper. So build schools, lower the taxes for these people. And help out those communities instead of $600 billion+ a year on the military. If you take $100 billion, if you take $10 billion, and you give it to every city, you know, that you can, the poorest cities in America, you know, if you take half of the budget, you cut the budget in half for the military, $300 billion, and over, I don't know, 3 years, you give the three poorest cities $100 billion, and you kind of manage how that money's going. You're investing it in schools and new roads and in more policing and more social workers. You're gonna see these communities uplift, and we kind of need to do that with the coal mines too, with these cities that have coal miners. We need to have those communities uplifted too, because we don't want to leave those people behind. We all need to prosper as Americans, but we kind of also need to rebudget here in America. We need to rebudget. We need to take the money that we're spending in other places and kind of focus it on our Americans instead of focusing it overseas. And I bring it up because I found it interesting that, as you know, the whole Black Lives Matter movement is happening, that you're kind of seeing companies like Jordan, and you're seeing the NFL and the NBA promise millions upon Jordan promise $100 million over 10 years. That's insane. That's a bunch of money. And I think the NFL was $250 million, and the NBA, it might have been $100 million, I think. That's so much money. And they've had this money there for years, and they've been investing it in what? You know, some people have been profiting. Instead of profiting, let's see everyone prosper. I think that it's a great thing, and I think that more companies need to, obviously, out of their own will, they need to start doing stuff like that and donating more money into these poor communities and being able to see these people prosper.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, with regard to the coal industry, as you were saying, I think we're reinvesting money into a dying car. So it's almost like you're buying a car which can't be repaired. You're trying to buff it up in the vision of repairing it, but instead of buying a new car.
Yeah.
So it's not a good thing, that not a good look for the nation.
Yeah, no, that's a great analogy. No, I was just going to say that's a great analogy.
And on the topic of basketball and the NBA, we saw kind of a sidetracking point for us to mention. Kyrie Irving, in a controversial statement, said that, once again, Kyrie Irving, the flat earther, as we mentioned last podcast, he said that the NBA should disband and the players should create a new league for their own profit. I don't know how true this is. I think that it starts in the frustration of the NBA opening up the league with so many big restrictions on players playing. So I think, I don't know if you've read this, Damian, but the NBA is making players stay in a bunch of hotels in Florida in a bubble.
Yeah,
exactly. They have no kind of living room, and it's kind of bogus to me. Restarting the NBA just for the fans' support, first of all, risking their lives, and second of all, not giving them the comfort and joy of enjoying a good life. How do you feel about that?
Well, I'd volunteer to go play basketball in that bubble. That bubble sounds nice, you know. They have spas, and I was hearing that they might have casinos and stuff in the bubble. I mean, this bubble sounds extremely nice. They're gonna have first class suites and stuff. It's crazy, but it's an obligation that the NBA has, and I think that the NBA is doing a good thing and that they're doing it responsibly. I think that, fortunately for the NBA, a lot of these guys are extremely healthy people. These are the top of the top when you're talking about health. So I don't think that they necessarily have a lot to fear in terms of getting extremely ill from the coronavirus, or getting really ill at all from the coronavirus. But I think that it's a good thing that they're kind of bringing it back, and I think that it's a good thing for the nation. Obviously, the players should have the free will to decide whether they're going to play or not. I think that the bubble's great. I think that they're doing a good thing. I'd go to the bubble. I'd go play in the bubble. If they're missing a couple people on a roster, they can sign me up. No promise that'll score any points, but I'll definitely volunteer to be in that bubble.
I think it's a good kind of statement that you made. It's not the worst bubble to be in with our nation, but I think that the other point that Kyrie Irving was mentioning, the Black Lives Matter movement may make it hard to restart the NBA because there's so many racial tensions going on in our nation. It's not the best time to kind of open up a basketball league when we're undergoing so much stress in our nation and so much anxiety and so much hurt in our nation. I think on that point, I do agree. I think the NBA should take into account the amount of fear and the amount of catastrophes our nation has been facing, give our nation time to heal before we can go into like sports like these, and give our players time to heal before we can go into sports like these.
I'm going to have to disagree with you, and I'm going to say that they don't have to give the nation time to heal. I think that they should help the nation heal. I think that they should help the nation heal by wearing maybe Black Lives Matter on the jerseys, or wearing a kind of movement telling their sponsors that 10% of the income that they get from the NBA, it has to be donated to the Black Lives Matter movement or to social justice. I think that they need to help the nation heal, and I think that as a big association and as a big kind of a very popular thing that a lot of Americans look up to, obviously, in the NBA and a lot of sports, you have a black majority, and that's definitely true in the NBA. I think that you need to have these prominent African-American males, affluent African-American males, be shown as strong on the basketball court and strong off the basketball court. And I think that that's how the NBA needs to proceed with this. I think that they need to take it head on and help the nation heal, as opposed to just sitting on the sidelines.
Yeah, I think that does kind of open up my mind with regards to opening up the NBA. I was conflicted, you know, talking about the BLM movement and opening up the NBA in the midst of this movement. Now I think that it's a semi-good thing on some circumstances, contingent upon the NBA raising awareness for the issues at hand. We had NBA players sit and stop for Kobe Bryant dying, which is obviously very, very saddening to myself, being a huge, huge fan of Kobe. They halted play, and they took like, I think, two pauses for Kobe Bryant in the beginning of a game and sacrificed their overall gameplay for Kobe Bryant's death. And seeing that happen for people like George Floyd and other big names in the kind of industry of race relations, I think it'd be a good thing for our nation. You know, having a movement of prayer for George Floyd and those that have been kind of killed by police brutality would be an awesome thing. Raising awareness for that movement, and it all starts with NBA players understanding that to use their platforms, to use your status as a player and as a basketball player to not shut up and dribble, but to show your support and solidarity for things like that.
Well, yeah, and I think that we've seen it throughout the civil rights movement starting in the 60s with Muhammad Ali, and you've always had athletes be on the front lines because J. Cole says a line that that really resonates with me strongly, and it always brings chills. He says something along the lines, I think I've mentioned it on the podcast before as well, but he says that the only time that an African-American really makes it out is whether they can fiddle with a mic, obviously rap or sing, or whether they can dribble and play with a basketball or a football. And oftentimes, unfortunately, in America, that's been true. And it's a line that unfortunately does resonate with I guess you could say a stereotype in a sense, but it's something that I think it has been truth throughout America. The most, when you think of prominent African-American people, you think Serena Williams, LeBron James, Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant. Obviously, you have people like Barack Obama and other politicians, but when you really think of prominent, rich African-American males, you know, you have the Shannon Sharps. If you're going to consider Stephen Curry and you know, mixed players as well as just full African American males, you think of athletes. You know, you have to think of athletes, and I think that it's the athletes' responsibilities to use their platform that they've been gifted in a sense, and obviously they have to work for it, but they've been gifted in a sense to better the nation and to better the social equality. And I think that it's stupid to tell them to shut up and dribble because they've never just shut up and dribble. Jackie Robinson made a stance. Muhammad Ali made a stance. Colin Kaepernick took a knee. And it's something that they need to do. They need to speak out because, unfortunately, they're the most prominent figures in the African-American community. Unfortunately, in the sense that you don't have a lot of business leaders you know, obviously in Tulsa, you had a prominent African-American community, but look what happened to them. You know, they were slaughtered. So I think that it's their responsibility.
And you cut out there for like a second. But I think I do have to agree that the basketball players and people like rappers like J. Cole have a very, very high influence with regards to politics and influence in their people. As you said, use your platform. You know, use your stance on a social standpoint to do that. And on a last note, you know, it's almost 3 minutes up till our ending kind of minute for our podcast. I wanted to mention how J. Cole, in his newest song, Snow on the Bluff, is talking a lot about how the Black Lives Matter movement was a good thing for our nation, and how police officers are kind of closing and locking up the mental state of people in our world. And I wanted to mention what he said specifically because it raised a lot of kind of controversy about his song and his stances. He said, "These shackles be locking the mental way more than the physical way. But the freedom like trees can't grow a forest like overnight." A lot about freedom and ghetto lifestyle and how he's being kind of shackled in by police officers, and he received so much hatred for it. It was so surprising. You know, he's talking about equality and raising awareness for equality and things like that, and he received so much kind of hatred behind it. You know, he's trying to say one thing and he receives the exact opposite. Oh, I think what he said this morning was, "Stand behind every word of the song that dropped last night." So how do you feel about J. Cole taking a stance? And this is going to be our last thing in the podcast, obviously. But how do you feel about J. Cole as a rapper taking a stance?
I think that anyone that knows me knows that I am probably the biggest J. Cole fan out there. I absolutely love J. Cole, and I've loved J. Cole for a minute now. And I think that he's always taken a stance. You know, he performed his tours in a jumpsuit. He did it for a reason. In 2016, his house was raided, and that's why he moved back to North Carolina. He's always talked about this stuff. You know, he made a song about the fact that that his neighbors thought that he was selling drugs, so he moved away. He moved out because his neighbors assumed that he was selling drugs, and then right thereafter, his house was raided. So luckily he wasn't home, but he's not had exclusive treatment because he's an affluent African American. Some might say that maybe he's even had worse treatment because of the fact that he speaks out against these issues. You know, I think that what J. Cole's doing is strong, and I think that he's doing what J. Cole has always done, and he's staying true to himself, and fortunately, his base has always loved him for that, and that's what I love him for. I love him for the fact that he can tell the stories of those less fortunate. You know, For Your Eyes Only, amazing song, amazing album. Love Yours, it's an incredible song on there. He talks a lot about the unequal treatment. You know, he performed a song, I can't remember the name of it right now, but he performed a song on live TV. I'll try to remember it for next time. I can bring it on the podcast, but I mean, it was an incredible song, and I started tearing up when I listened to it, because it really talks about, this was after, I don't remember whose death, but after another African-American male's death, I think in 2014, he performed a song talking about how we're struggling in this nation. You know, he has the bars, the only time they see us is on the news, locked up in chains, or tied up in chains. He's always talked about this stuff, and I think that it's important for him now to ride this wave and to show that he's going to stand up for those who are less fortunate. He's doing what J. Cole has always done, and I have to say that I'm proud of him.
Back to him. I think hopefully people look at what he's doing and listen to his song lyrics and understand that there is an inequality in our nation beyond what we've been seeing reported. And it's been there for so long. And again, just I respect him completely for what he's done, and I'm definitely going to for a long, long, long time. And 12:21, you know, it's in Atlanta. It's the end of our podcast today. It's been over an hour. Wanted to end by obviously saying a couple of things, like we always say. Always follow our Twitter at PolitiTeamShow, or email us at PolitiTeamPodcast@gmail.com. Over that platform. Thank you to all of our supporters on the Change.org petition. We received over 3,000 responses for that. And we got a response back from Forsyth County Schools saying that they're looking into the issue and hopefully contact law enforcement about the overall situation that happened. If you haven't seen it, obviously go to change.org/justice and FOCO to read the story and contribute to the cause, supported by myself, Damien, and our classmates. And I wanted to end on a similar note, as we've been ending on for the past couple of episodes. My perspective, use your platform. As J. Cole has done, as NBA players across the board have done, use your platform in the right way and to promote unity and equality for all instead of fear and vulnerability as Trump has done.
Yep.
It's important for us to promote the right things.
Yeah, go out and have a conversation, ladies and gentlemen. As we always say when we're ending the podcast, go out and have a conversation. It's the only way that change is going to be created. Even if you don't agree with someone, go out and listen to them and get their perspective. It's the only way that we're really going to understand each other as Americans. Go out, dinner, talk about politics. Don't be afraid to share your voice, regardless of the backlash that you might face, even from us, you know? Even from us. We might criticize some of the things that you say, but it's criticism. And criticism needs to be the way forward. Constructive criticism needs to be the way forward. But with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, we hope that you guys did enjoy this podcast. I personally loved it. I think that it was an amazing podcast for today. And be sure to have a good night.
Peace out, y'all. Hello, everybody. Once again, this is Varun. The date is June 17th, 2020, and it is our 8th installment of the Polititeen podcast. Thank you so much for watching the entirety of our podcast today. We do really, really, really appreciate your overwhelming support. And that said, make sure to follow our Twitter at Polititeen Show, and make sure to connect with us via Gmail at PolititeenPodcast@gmail.com. Truly value your support over these past couple of weeks, and continue to watch our podcasts and stay tuned for Friday's interview with Krista Olenzak, a candidate for House District 26 in Georgia. And thank you so much for watching today's podcast. Peace out, Polititeen family.